Welcome to Conversations in MedEd, the people behind the research. Hi, Nabila. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Nikki. Thanks for having me.
Such a pleasure. So maybe you can just introduce who you are to our listeners. What do you do and where do you find yourself?
Absolutely. So I'm Nabila Kaji. I'm a medical doctor, and I'm really interested in understanding medical education concepts like communication skills and how they intersect with interventions like mindfulness training. This is specifically in medical education, that is the training of medical students. I'm currently in South Africa, but I'm a Rhodes Scholar doing my DPhil at the University of Oxford. And so I'm doing some fieldwork in South Africa at the moment.
Fantastic. And maybe you can just explain a little bit about how does a medical doctor go to doing a DPhil or a doctorate in medical education? What was that? What sort of sparked that interest, or why do you have you transitioned perhaps out of medicine and into medical education?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think something I would have loved to have known when I was in medical school, because it's taken me a long time, you know, to get here and understand some of these things. So I'm one of the sort of rare medical doctors that loves things outside of the hospital as much as I love things in the hospital. So I still am involved in clinical practice. But now what I am doing is more research and also teaching. And what led me there really was a curiosity about how science was generated in medicine. You know, how do we actually provide the evidence base for the work that we do, the choices we make in medicine, how we teach medical students? It's been a really interesting journey. I don't necessarily know exactly how I ended up on this trajectory, other than to say that I've had a wonderful set of mentors from the time that I was in medical school who guided me. And I landed into medical education really through a sequence of events that that led me to do a little bit of research in medical education with Prof. Susan von Skalkbeek and Dr. Jonas Bavane. And we did research looking at medical students and their involvement in research. So it was a very metacognitive project, you know, research about research in medical students. But that was really my first research study. And it led me down the road of becoming more and more interested in medical education. And I continued to do that even through my internship community service working as a clinical doctor. And it's now part of my PhD. So that's sort of the road that I've taken. I definitely still see myself doing clinical practice, though. So a little bit of a hybrid career. Yeah.
Fantastic. And what is your doctorate on? Like, what topic? You mentioned mindfulness and communication. Do you have a specific focus? And how do you come to sort of become interested in that focus?
Yeah. So it's a very intersectional project. I should say that from the outset. I'm housed in the Department of Psychiatry, but the area that I'm interested in, you know, the acceptability and feasibility of mindfulness training interventions for communication skills in medical students crosses many areas. It crosses linguistics and communication skills. It crosses mental health, empathy, burnout. It also crosses the sociological understandings of how people interact in dynamic ways and in teams. So quite a number of areas that intersect, although I'm housed in the Department of Psychiatry. Interestingly, you know, what is also, I think, an interesting, how do we then end up at this intersectional point? Medical education research often is very intersectional. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because we're training healthcare professionals who have quite dynamic needs. And it's very exciting to see that health professions education research is following that, you know, that change and that trajectory change with it becoming more and more dynamic.
And empathy, is that where your study is going to sort of focus? And what do you mean by empathy? Is it a inherent trait that people are born with, or is it a skill that can be developed? So how do you understand empathy, and why are you specifically looking at empathy in your doctorate?
Yeah, empathy is something that has garnered quite a lot of interest, both in research spaces and also with public attention. What is so interesting to me about empathy as an outcome measure to study is, in some ways, empathy is at the heart of humanistic medical practice and healthcare practice. And it's something that we're realizing more and more is potentially at risk in a profession that is becoming more and more digitized, and also in a time where time burdens mean that there's less and less patient contact time. It's also distressing, I think, as an individual post the COVID-19 pandemic, to see the ways in which our world is changing, and the pressures that are on healthcare systems and the pressures that are on training healthcare professionals, specifically also doctors, which is, you know, my area of looking at medical students. So all of those factors, I think, have driven me to become more and more interested in empathy as a concept. How is it defined? Empathy has been defined in many ways by different groups. And there's, in fact, a lot of contention around the definition of empathy. Though the definition that is often used in medical education with medical students is the Hojet et al. Definition. And, you know, this is through the Jefferson Project. And what they define empathy as is the ability to use cognitive empathy in understanding the experiences of patients and then having the desire to do something about it. It does not necessarily underpin the affective or emotional parts of empathy that other definitions do espouse. And there are even other definitions that include moral aspects of empathy. And so the predominant feature of cognitive aspects of empathy in the definition we widely use in medical education, and also the aspects, as I say, that relate to outcome, are very interesting because, you know, those aspects are absolutely important in the practice of empathy. And yet, I think there's been a lot of pushback in the research base around, aren't emotional and affective aspects of empathy also important? And, you know, if you look at definitions that extend outside of medical education into the sociological sciences, into psychology, those areas are more prominent. And, you know, there are also important pieces regarding empathy around empathy fatigue or empathy distress, and what the impact might be of experiencing another's phenomena, whether it's distress or pain. And so it's interesting, from the Hojet et al. Definition, they don't necessarily say that the doctor or the healthcare professional is experiencing it, but rather that they're understanding it. And so there's a little bit more of a dissociation from that experience in the Hojet et al. Definition. So I've become really interested in how empathy relates to mental health attributes, and how, such as burnout, and how it also relates to the development of other communication skills in respect of mindfulness training. There's been a lot of interest in the research base around how we can protect empathy, how we can cultivate empathy. Is empathy only a dispositional trait, or can we train it? And that's a very polarizing area in the research base, I think, for reasons that are complex, but also interesting, right? That there are a lot of interesting research questions there. I think often where there's polarization, there's need for more research, you know?
Definitely.
Yeah, so it's lovely to be able to that area, some of our research, and explore that, those relationships a little bit better. One of the pieces that we're very interested in the work we are doing in is looking at something called the empathy tank, which is by authors Lang and Chain. And they've looked at the ability or capacity to provide empathy as a tank, if you will consider it like a water tank or an oil tank. So there's an input and there's an output. So it can be filled up or it could be emptied. And in their article, they describe the importance of what goes into that empathy tank. So personal experiences, donated experiences from other people, our ability to receive empathy from others in our day-to-day lives through our experiences, whether those experiences are as a patient or not, as a healthcare provider. And then also building of self-awareness, building of tools that can help one recognize when one's empathy tank is diminishing. And then the output, being able to give to patients, noticing when patients need empathy, sort of the nuances of empathy that can be sustained. And in this literature base, there's an interesting piece about feigned or sort of fake empathy, that is over-systemized empathy, you know, where one loses the ability to really relate in a very real moment-to-moment way with patients. And so it's a complex system, but when we simplify it as an empathy tank, I really like this model because it gives us the capacity to understand what we can potentially do about empathy from an input and an output perspective. And, you know, our research fits into the input part of it, but also the output part of it. The input part of it, because we want to know, how is it that we may be able to resource medical students? How might we be able to provide a space for reflection and a narrative expression that is often cited in this literature base around refueling empathy and processing challenging circumstances around empathy? And then in the output part of it, how are we able to provide medical students with a capacity to notice, a self-awareness to notice when they're becoming under-resourced or depleted, and be bodily aware, but also mentally aware of that need, which is characteristically in the research an interesting area of neglect surrounding the self-care and the healthcare of doctors themselves around their own mental and physical health. And so that's where mindfulness training fits in this research question, is asking the question, is mindfulness training useful in empathy and communication skills development? And in the context of mental health, how is that connected to burnout and empathy? And so it's a complex system, but I think it asks quite a few questions that are really important for doctors at this point in time.
Definitely. Very interesting, very necessary. Do you have, I know it's complex and you're still in the middle of your research project, but do you have any sort of recommendations or practical advice for how we can think about filling up our tank and noticing when it's sort of dropping low for ourselves, but also for our students? I know there's a lot, like you said, mindfulness. Are there any other sort of evidence-based principles from the field that you can sort of at this stage give some emerging guidelines?
Absolutely. I think this area is such an interesting area for exactly that. It's becoming a very generative space, and there's a lot of translational research being done in this area. I think there's levels of different individuals that will have different empathy needs. And I think that's important to say from the outset, because, you know, that input and output mechanism will be quite different if, for example, let's say on the one end of the spectrum, you are a training medical student, right? All the way through to if you are a specialist, perhaps in palliative care or oncology, or an area that is very high demand for empathy. And then you have other specialties which may require empathy, but perhaps quite a lot less. For example, if one is a radiologist or if one is not working directly with patients. Yeah. And so I think sort of first filtering and understanding the empathy needs of the individual, and recognizing, I think, also that we as individuals exist within a micro, macro, and meso environment, and that the basis or the emphasis for empathy should not only rest upon the individual, although that is important, is that that barometer should also exist at an immediate environment level around the meso environment, and then also on a macro level in terms of policies that protect and allow for healthcare professionals to be supported when they need that support. And so I think first level of empathy and thinking about empathy is, if we go back to that tank model, is thinking about ways in which we can replenish empathy tanks within healthcare professionals and those that are also training healthcare professionals, because I think that's, you know, predominantly our listener base, is that the first step really is to have a sustainability about that input mechanism. So there are obviously innate qualities that people have dispositionally, either to be more empathetic or not. But I think self-reflection is a huge part of cultivating capacities and changing behavior. So self-reflection, and that may take the space of journaling, reflective journaling, that could take the space of narrative medicine, writing out stories, reflecting upon experiences, poetry. A number of medical schools have encouraged the arts. And in fact, there are a number of studies that have looked at theater and the arts in changing perspective and shifting mindsets. And there's also a lot of interesting research also around doing and engaging in activities that one may find to be mentally resourcing and assist with co-regulation. And that can range everything from exercise to getting enough sleep to taking good enough care of oneself, and sort of the basic mechanisms that support healthy psychology. I think a big piece of that also in terms of input is recognizing when people need additional support beyond their norm, whether that is in the form of therapy or in the form of any additional support mechanisms that one might need within their immediate working environment. I think there's another piece to that as well, which is that in order to feel empathetic, one should also be receiving empathy. And in the empathy tank model, they speak to the value of receiving empathy and the ability to then give empathy. And I think this speaks to what I spoke about a little bit earlier around the culture and the climate that the individual finds themselves in, because that's also quite important in that network. And then on the output side of things in terms of advice, I think there's two big pieces there that potentially are important. The one is, I think, the nuances of the healthcare professional understanding how to use empathy, because time is scarce, resources are limited, all of those things are true, but it is also possible to navigate the degree to which an empathic response is required, how much empathy is required in a particular circumstance. So for example, if one has a patient that is coming for a flu shot, right, perhaps that case might require a lot less empathy than someone who's just learned that they have terminal cancer, right? It may not necessarily be the case. The patient that's come in for the flu jab might tell you, actually, they just lost their dog that morning, or they just had a terrible day, right? But I think navigating what is in front of you and being able to adjust the requirements or the needs of patients is important, that sort of temporality. And then the second part of it, I would say, is understanding how to navigate your resourcing and notice when your level of resourcing is low and when it is high. And I think being honest with patients around your capacity is also important. And this is something that I think is becoming more and more evident in the literature, is around error, medical error, and around communication, is communicating in a way that is dynamic and generative with patients and honest. And to say, you know, I'm able to offer this, you know, perhaps at our follow-up visit, we can attend further to these items if they're not emergencies, for example. And so I think instead of neglecting something entirely, to have a follow-up is often been shown in the literature to be an opportunity for empathy. Where there isn't time or capacity in the immediate moment. So I think navigating where and how to use empathy, but also who needs empathy and when you may or may not be resourced enough or you need to put more into the tank, that could be a really good way to protect healthcare professionals from running on too low for too long and causing distress.
Thank you. No, you've raised so many interesting and intersecting ideas. I'm sort of struggling to think about which road to go down because there's so many possible areas we could chat about. But maybe just thinking about the developing or embedding empathy training, you know, like you said, understanding, you know, how much to give and in what capacity. And how do you think you can do that from perhaps like an undergraduate right through to a postgraduate or graduate level? Is it through something like including it in a PBL case study, or is it through storytelling where a patient comes into the lecture room? Is it through, you know, modeling it as a senior when you have juniors around the patient bedside? Any sort of ways you can think about it at a curriculum or pedagogy level?
Oh, yeah. I think there's so many interesting ways. You see, I think what's an important piece here, and I think this is really interesting, is there's sort of two pieces or two pathways often that are taught empathy. The one is sort of direct or primary empathy, which is often what you say to patients and how you say it. And teaching tools, as I've explained, around the experiential elements and the processing elements of those interactions, reflection. But then there's a second part, which is also sort of what we would describe as secondary qualities. And those would relate to tone, pause, presence, and the way you hold space, which are sort of more peripheral areas. And those areas are perhaps, they take a bit more time. Both of those areas perhaps take different types of training to cultivate. I think what's really interesting about your question is how do we start to develop a career trajectory for empathy? Yeah. You know, not looking at empathy as a one shot, but really as something that we sort of cumulatively develop. And there's been quite a lot of research looking at empathy across medical education. And the trend that we're seeing in the research base is that empathy decreases with training time in medical schools. And that's sort of replicated across various spaces and continents. And that's concerning. Yeah. That's really concerning. And there is a lot of research that is now exploring why is that the case on a micro, macro and meso level. And so I think part of understanding how we should integrate it is really on an institutional level, understanding what is the driver of decreasing empathy in that space, because obviously those would be barriers to address. And then in terms of your question more fully, facilitators of empathy, some medical schools internationally use something called situational judgment tests, where when they recruit medical students, one of the important attributes they look for is empathy. For example, or compassion, for example. And there are also other attributes that are often looked for in those situational judgment tests around logic and so forth. But I think what's interesting is going back to that question of how do we develop empathy? So medical students come in and they presumably will be a normal distribution of empathy across individuals. And then how do we develop that to the nuances of being a healthcare professional? I think that is really interesting because we want to improve specialization in empathy, which is what I was speaking about the fine tuning of how to make it sustainable and how to offer empathy in everyday practice in a way that is received by patients. And I think what is really interesting to see is that medical curricula are becoming more and more flipped in some ways, as you pointed out, which I think is so interesting, is how do we actually teach medical students? And nowadays, what is so interesting is that medical students are being taught more and more by patients themselves.
Yeah.
I was sitting the other day in a lecture where a type 1 diabetic was giving a talk on what it is like to live with type 1 diabetes. And what I found so interesting is at the end of the session, the questions that were asked of the patient were actually medical questions. Wow. How often do you take your insulin? What do you do when your HGTs, your sugars are too high? And, you know, what happens if you do eat pizza and your sugar skyrockets? What do you do? And if your friends want to have a drink of alcohol and you know that your sugar could be influenced, what do you do? And, you know, sort of really getting to the crux of some of the questions that actually lecturers would really struggle to answer because most of them have not lived with those conditions. And so I think this is really interesting, sort of flipping the empathy model, which is where we potentially don't learn empathy from other healthcare professionals. We reflect our empathy on patients and ask patients, how would you like me to tell you this? What would you wish you had heard? How would you have liked to have been interacted with in that experience? I think that's something that we as healthcare professionals through a co-creation model can learn so much more. And quite a number of medical schools are moving in that direction to change the way in which we grapple with this concept of empathy. I think there are also interesting pieces around generational differences in empathy. And, you know, I think this is also interesting because that's something that, again, we have to contend with, the shifts in the way society understands empathy and relates to each other. And then a third piece, I would say, around training and cultivating empathy across the training spectrum is starting to also understand that the demands of the profession increase potentially through specialization in medicine. And we as, you know, health professions educators need to think more carefully about the tools we're using to train empathy. Up to now, quite a lot of those tools have been didactic, meaning giving in lectures or talking to students about empathy. But as I spoke to you about now with the theater and the arts, mindfulness training, narrative reflection, poetry, these are examples from social sciences and psychology and the humanities at large that offer us the ability to extend outside of ourselves in an experiential teaching method. And so I think that's a fascinating area of research in empathy, is how do we make empathy experiential, not just thought of, cognitive, as I've spoken about earlier, the definition.
No, thanks. That's incredibly powerful, everything. I mean, my interest is obviously a bit in sort of decolonial thinking, and I see this sort of rehumanization of the profession and sort of breaking down of hierarchies and having the patient, like patient and public involvement, having the patient as the expert, seeing one another as human beings and not sort of infallible superheroes who, you know, we're human. And, you know, I think as someone who's not a health professional, I've also been guilty of sort of idolizing health professionals and not seeing them as human beings first. And I think the power of arts and storytelling and the diversity of what counts as knowledge and evidence and good practice, it's really encouraging to see this sort of shift and rehumanization of the profession. Time is flying, and while I would love to keep chatting for another 30 minutes, any sort of last thoughts or reflections, either about empathy or your transition, not out of medicine, but sort of including education into your clinical practice, or even thinking about context and communication, how that might be an interesting thing to think about, you know, within South Africa, or any last reflections or encouragements for listeners? It's really up to you on the final word.
Thank you, Nikki. I think a big piece for me would be to say that I think I want to encourage other people who are interested in doing more research in empathy and communication skills in medicine to go for it. I think this is going to be one of the most important areas of research in the next decade, at least, if not century, because we're shifting into a world that is placing so much attentional demand on all of us all the time. We're pulled between the digital space and the so-called real world and that in-between space all the time. And those attentional demands have a potential huge ramification on communication skills and the way we hold space for each other, specifically in the healthcare setting. And I really am very excited to see what comes up, not just in our research, but also in the researches of others in this area. And I hope that we can also have more research with the humanistic lens, not just an efficiency orientated model that just looks at reduction of mistakes and error, although that is important, but also to look at the wider net of communication also being a very personal experience to the patient. And that communication experience also has an impact on the doctors and the healthcare professionals that are engaging in it. So that would be my last piece.
Thank you. Thanks, Nabila. And you've heard the call, listeners. I mean, I feel very excited and I can't wait to see where your research leads. And I definitely hope to see more of it in the future. But thank you so much for your time and all the food for thought you've given us today.
Likewise. Thank you, Nikki. And thank you to our listeners.
Pleasure. I am Danica Sims, your host and producer. Thank you for joining Conversations in MedEd. Hit subscribe and leave a review. I love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or questions or recommended guests, please get in contact with me. Contact details can be found in the show notes. Are you passionate about education? Are you interested in conducting educational research? Are you considering obtaining a formal qualification in health professions education? The University of Oxford offers a part-time, two-year master's in medical education through the Department of Education in partnership with the medical school. We introduce students to numerous topics, theory, and evidence from the field, and support them in conducting their own educational research project. For more details, visit the Department of Education webpage. Links can be found in the show notes.